This is conversation number 5, continued, with Miss Gibb, the Grove Lazare, March the 7th, 1973. Miss Gibb, it's been suggested that I should ask you about beekeeping when you were younger, because, of course, it was quite different to beekeeping today, and I believe you still have some of the old beekeeping apparatus, if you can call it like that.
Yes. Well, I never could do very much with them. I could stand by with a veil over my head and so on and hand things to people. But the bees disliked me so that they generally stung me on sight.
It's a bit hard.
So that I really couldn't do very much. But we have one or two skeps, and, you know, they were very decorative, those hives with a straw tied in a bunch at the top and then all flowing down and covering them, that the rain ran off. Of course, there was an art in making that, but old Corlett made them quite well.
Yeah, were they plaited?
No, it was, got a sheaf, a good thick sheaf, and you tied it tightly at the top, and then you stroked it out so that it was equal thickness all the way round, leaving a little slit in the front for the bees to come and go at the opening there was to the straw hive that they lived in below it. I'll just get it.
We have two hives here.
Now,
that's the bigger one, is it?
This is the hive they lived in. And you see the, well, of course, it's wear and age. But there was a sort of little place there that when it was flat, the bees could just get in and out.
Yes.
Well, then they lived in that. Then that was put on the top for them to fill it with honey. And there's a little glass in that that you could see,
yes.
Supposed to be able to see if it was full or not. And when it was full, you took it away and scooped the comb out and extracted the honey.
Well, I'll be blurred. Now, this glass here, is this, what's it stuck in with? What is
I don't
that?
Know. It's worked into it in some way.
Looks like a sort of putty. It can't be mud, can it?
Oh, it could be. I don't think that wire has anything to do with it.
But this is what I was meaning about the plaiting. You
yes.
See, it goes round and round
yes,
and round.
Yes, it does.
And then it's bound with coarse straw, isn't it?
Yes, it would be withies, wouldn't it?
Withies, yes, probably.
Either willow or bent.
Yes.
From the shore, wouldn't it?
Well, they certainly look like sort of wood, don't they, rather
yes.
than straw.
Yes.
So you sat... You had the big one on the table.
Yes.
And then the bees went in there.
And this, of course, was what your bees lived in.
And
you didn't disturb that.
A three-inch circular hole in the top.
Mm.
The whole thing about...
18 inches.
About 18 inches diameter.
Mm.
And then the smaller one, which is, oh, lordy.
Oh, that's nothing.
The smaller one, which is about a foot in diameter,
yes.
with the glass window, that simply sat loose on top, did it?
Yes, just loose. And then you see the straw was tied up in a bunch here and flowed down all the way around.
In addition... There was straw put on the outside of this beehive, was there?
Yes, because the rain the rain, if the straw tub was properly made, the rain never penetrated. It just flowed up.
Like an umbrella.
Yes, exactly.
I see. Mm. So you the two basketwork beehives on the table,
yes,
and then you had the sheaf of straw,
yes,
made in the shape of an umbrella, put over both of them.
Yes.
To shed the
rain.
It
really was like a tent, exactly the shape of a tent, you
yeah.
see.
Huh.
And I last year I found those two in the loft, the only two that weren't broken in any way, and I brought them into the schoolroom thinking that someday I would ask Mr. Cubbon if they would like them.
Jolly good.
You can take them away with you now if you'd feel like it.
Well, I should think the thing to do is pop them back in the schoolroom for now, and I'll tell him about them, you know, later on.
Yes, that'll do.
When they'd made their comb.
Yes.
What did you do?
Well.
You took your umbrella off.
You took the umbrella off.
Yes.
And would take this away.
The
or else
away.
You might put a bell glass on the top of that. If it was a good year. And they would come up through this hole, which is bunged up.
Yes,
with something.
The small hole in the top one as well.
Yes, and fill the bell glass. But, of course, it was a very slow process then, because they had to make the honeycomb to hold it. Nowadays, you put in artificial stuff, and they pull it out.
I see.
Johnny's very good with bees, very. He can pick up, I've seen him pick up a swarm in his hands like that.
Mm. So if it was a very good year, you looked through the window of the top basket,
mm,
you saw that it was nearly full of honey and in a comb.
Yes.
And so you then pulled out the piece of paper from the top small hole in the top basket and you put a bell glass on top of that.
Yes.
And then when they'd filled the small basket, they went up into the bell glass on the roof of the small basket and made another comb, didn't
yes.
they? Yes. And what were the bell glasses like? Like a cake or a cheese thing, were they?
Yes, just like that, very much like that cheese dish cover that's there. Only not flat on the top. They went up to a point like the straw did, rather.
Mm-hmm.
Really, they were just the shape of a bell.
I see.
Narrow at the top and a little wider down below.
Mm-hmm.
This, you see, is the same width all the way. Well, it went up to very small at the top. I'm afraid the last of them is broken, but I'll look.
And how many hives did you have?
Well, at one time Auntie had four. And then for a long time I think Alice had three. And then they a bad winter, I think. Don't know what she lost two hives and replaced one of them. And then we had two. Now we've only one.
You have one now, haven't
yes.
you? Yes. Well, a modern one. With all the labour-saving devices for the bees in it.
Well, it's the present one is a funny little box. Freddie Quine, Mrs. Kissack's brother, very good with bees, and he undertook to look after these bees. In fact, I think a year or 2 years before Alice died. Might be 2 years. It was after Minnell had gone, I think. The Queen went out for her fertilizing flight in February. Beautiful sunny day, but frosty. And I suppose she got frosted and dropped. And the hive was without a queen. And eventually died out. And Freddy had a swarm that he hadn't a hive for. And he knew this had happened. And so he brought them down here. And the hive was fairly clean. And he put them in there. Well, then, last autumn, when he took the honey, he said the hive was, parts of it were getting rotten, and he rehoused them. So he brought down a funny little box one day. I didn't see him that day. I didn't know it had happened even. And he put them in. And it was a very poor year for honey, so I didn't think there would be any at all. And he said, oh, I think your bees have done better than any of mine out at Bride. And what did he say he got? He got, I think he got 18 pounds of honey out of the comb.
Did he?
And I know he said to me, here is your honey. And I said, oh, well, it's your honey, really. And he said, we'll share it. So I think he'd 10 pounds and I'd 8.
While you've been out, I'm afraid I've been being inquisitive. Can you tell me, where did that clock come from? How old is it?
Well, it was a wedding present to my grandmother in 1830, June 15th or 16th, 1830. And it has been going ever since and shows very little signs of wear. And Mr. and either Merle or Paul Matthews told Mr. Carter Brain about it. And he said if he might come and photograph it. He had a friend in, I think it's Liverpool, who was an expert on clocks and things, and he would send the photographs to him and find out if it was true what I said. Because like the old clock man here who died this last year, he could hardly believe that it was new in 1830 and showing very little signs of wear. In fact, no sign of wear except that the minute hand is slightly loose. And when you wind it, it sometimes drops back a little. So he came and, oh, what a paraphernalia. White cloths and the thing set up on the sideboard and lights on and lights off and photographed it from every angle, I think. And I think he wasn't quite satisfied because he came back a second time. And then he sent me the result. And the man told him, the maker or one of the helpers, if it wasn't signed in some way by the maker's name, it would be one of the others who made clocks. Certainly 1830 was quite all right. This man worked from 1825 onwards, and there are very few of his clocks in existence, and it's very precious. Oh, I've got the thing in the sideboard there, an awful lot about it. The man's name and all the rest.
Do you remember the man's name?
No, I don't.
Oh, this is the letter Mr. Carter Brain gave you, is it?
Yes.
I see it is dated the Liverpool Museums, City of Liverpool Museum, 7th of March, 1972, and signed by L.A. Berman, Keeper, Departments of Ceramics and Applied Art. I'm going to read it, if I may.
Well, yes, do.
I have now had an opportunity to examine with some care the photographs of the skeleton clock belonging to Miss Gibb. It is, of course, extremely difficult to judge from photographs, especially as those in question do not reveal clearly the details of the mechanism required for precise judgment. However, it can be said that this clock is almost certainly English, and I have the impression, which does not emerge clearly in the photographs, that it has one very unusual feature, namely the gearing of the main wheel and pinions is helical. This would indicate that it may have been made by, or in imitation of, the work of Charles MacDowell, 1790 to 1872, of Leeds and Wakefield. Other features present in this clock which would lead to the same conclusion are the form of dead beat escapement with its pallets and crutch pivoted between the frames, the method of suspension of the pendulum, and the pendulum itself with its large lenticular bob, semi-triangular section, and coarse screw adjustment below. It seems unusual that it should not be signed, as MacDowell seemed to make a point of signing his clocks. It may be that this clock is by an imitator of MacDowell, of whom there were a number here and in Germany, but I do not think any took the principle of helical gearing as far as he did. On the other hand, it may be an early clock, which would agree with the reported date of purchase, executed when MacDowell was perfecting his invention. The simplicity of the frame and the retaining screws of its pillars would indicate this. In any case, unless I am mistaken, my interpretation of the photographs, this is a most interesting and quite rare clock, and I am very glad to have known of it.
It is quite possible that it was this man's clock make, and that it has dated from there. But I don't think my old aunt, having lived with it all her life, couldn't have made any mistake, you see.
It was a wedding present, 1830, full stop.
Yes.
Yeah. I was being naughty and looking around
while
you were out. Now, what on earth is this? It obviously clamps onto the table, and those things pull out.
Now, there's your wool winder. You put the scales on that and the skein, and you wind your wool.
The skein goes where?
The skeins fit into these, you see.
You
can make them bigger or smaller accordingly, whether you... Oh, dear me, the dozens of skeins of wool I've wound on there.
Now, what date is that?
Oh, about from the same time. It was Granny's, and I wound wool for Granny when I was, I don't suppose I was more than 5 or 6, but it was quite an occupation, and you know.
And it is early Victorian, anyway.
Oh, very much so.
It's really rather beautiful.
Yes.
Because...
I've lent it to other people to wind wool when my Mrs. Kissack had, I've forgotten how much wool she had, several pounds anyway. Because she was knitting things to go to New Zealand. And I said, would you like the wool winder? And that's why it's out. It otherwise was in the ottoman under the window.
Because the clamp part and the main stem looks like walnut, doesn't it?
Yes, perhaps so.
I think so. And then these expanding arms, which can give you any size of skein, I suppose.
Yes, you see.
Well, there he comes in, small skein. And what's the little thing on the top for?
For the ball, if you're held up, you put your ball on there and leave it till you come back and finish it.
I see.
It's awful neat, you
Isn't
know.
Isn't it? Beautiful little thing.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's a beauty. And this wood on the top here, what would you say that is? Because
yes.
It's rather nice wood. It looks
it
like,
is,
a,
isn't it,
looks like a peach wood or something
yes.
like that, doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
Contrasting colour. Very good.
Save instead of holding the thing in your hands, you know, like an odd skein, of course. We didn't bother to get it out, but if there were more than one skein, oh yes, out it came.
And in your childhood's day, did you use wool yarn from a cross, or did you use Manx wool, or both?
Oh, well, both. A lot of the granny, of course, knit. She knitted beautifully, and she knitted fine things and things. I suppose for us when we were babies, and when my cousin had twins, she knit a lot of little vests and jackets for them. And it was always ladyship wool.
From Halifax, that
yes.
is.
But several people, when they'd seen it lying there, said to me, what in the world could you use that for?
Mm, very nice.
It doesn't really look a very useful thing, sort of thing.
Mm. And the big portrait over the chimneypiece, is that your grandfather?
Great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather?
Yes, Granny's father. That was old James Blake. And he was a direct descendant of the old Admiral Blake that swept the
Dutch.
The English Channel. From the a direct descendant of the younger son. The old Admiral apparently had two sons. This man was... And this man sailed the world. He was a ship surgeon until he was about 40, when he retired and married. And he and his brother ran soap works at Bristol for a time. His headquarters were always Liverpool, but...
They were originally a Liverpool family, were they, the Blakes?
I think so. Well, now wait a minute. Really, they came from somewhere in Northumberland, I think, to begin with.
Mm-hmm. And who is...
And that was his eldest granddaughter.
Eldest granddaughter?
Yes, and she was about 6 or 7. He was getting on for 80 when that was taken. And because like Will, he married late in life. He was, I think he was 40 before he married.
So that's your grandmother's niece?
Granny's eldest daughter. Granny was his daughter, you
yeah.
see, and the girl is the was Granny's daughter, my Aunt Elizabeth.
Oh, that is your Aunt Elizabeth?
Yes, father's eldest sister.
I see.
There were four girls and then 3 boys. And father was the only one that lived to grow up of the boys. The girls all survived.
So that picture must date back to...
Well, Aunt Lizzie
basis,
was born...
About 1845.
She was born in... ...1831, I think.
Yeah.
And she was about 6.
Yeah, it's about sort of 1840, isn't it?
Yes.
As a picture.
Mm.
Splendid.
See, it was before photographs had come in.
Oh, yes, yes. Very much so. And the old gentleman, side face on in the lower picture here.
Over there?
No, this one here.
Oh,
this,
that's, what's his name? The engineer, you know, isn't it?
What, Brunel or someone like that? Brunel?
What was his name? No. Steam engine, wasn't it?
Watts?
Yes.
That's Watts, is it?
Yes.
That's just a lithograph, is it, or something?
Yes.
Just sort of been there all your life?
Yes.
Now, which is your grandfather of these?
Well, he's across there, and Granny always said was a very bad likeness. He got some young man who needed the money to paint him. And it was always in the office in Liverpool because she wouldn't have it in the house.
Oh, I see.
But eventually it came here.
You don't know who did your great-grandfather?
Yes.
You don't know who did that one? Who painted it?
No. They say it's good. A man who got in here by mistake, we thought he was somebody, piano tuner or something, someone we were expecting but didn't know very well, and he got in, and he'd come to buy pictures or anything else we'd sell. Oh, what a job we had to get rid of him.
They're dangerous people, these.
And he wanted that particular. The other pictures, he said, were quite good, but that, he said, really is a good picture.
Very, very large, isn't it? The frame is in excellent condition.
But in the end, I think he suggested he would perhaps come back again, and we said he needn't. We'd be a waste of time.
The lady here in the sort of the lace cap?
Well, that was... Now... That was an old... A Mrs. Clare, and her daughter was this old man's wife.
I see. So she's the mother-in-law of Mr. Blake.
Yes. And those were his two daughters. Granny, aged about 20.
Which is
before she married, the one nearer the door. It's got a hole in it, ought to go to somebody to be repaired. But
the one near
the door. And her sister in this one.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see them very well in this light.
Your grandmother then is the one with the locket.
Yes.
And your great aunt is the one with the sort of chain.
Yes.
Hanging down. They're very much alike, aren't they?
Oh, they were very much alike. And then, of course, the hairdressing being alike. But even in older age, in photographs, in the drawing room, they're quite alike.
Mm.
Strictly speaking, I believe, Aunt Ralph was... we called her Aunt Ralph because she was our great aunt, and she was a Mary, and Father's sister was Mary. So Aunt Mary was Aunt Mary, and our great aunt was Aunt Ralph. And strictly speaking, she was the more beautiful, but Granny had a sparkle in her eyes, and she was, I don't know, more alive looking.
Mm.
They were supposed to be the most beautiful girls in Liverpool in their day.
Well, they were nurtured on the milk in the back premises in Old Parliament Street.
Yes.
Yes, I loved that story. It was very, very good.
Mm.
Very, very good.
They brought the country into the town in a marvellous way for people who could afford it.
Yes. This is conversation number 6 with Miss Gibb of the Grove Les Zaire. The 14th of March, 1973. Miss Gibb, I ventured to ask Johnny Crellin if he could suggest some questions which would be of great interest if they happened to come within your memory, and I've got a number of them here, so if I may ask you them in order, and we can see how much you can throw light upon what he wants to know. Firstly, the house itself, the Grove. He says that it has many features which are similar to Thurow Cottage, built in 1809, and Beech House Castletown, built in 814, and he wonders if you have ever heard the name of, or read of, who was the architect who redesigned the original cottage for your grandfather?
No, never. Unfortunately, never. But I only know this, that the same architect did this and added to Ballerina, the Andreas, where the Neils lived. And they had, the then owner, had a front built onto the old house just in the same manner as this is done. But they have a large hall and smaller rooms, but the proportions of the whole thing are very much the same.
And was Ballerina also putting a house round a house?
Yes.
Just the same as the Grove?
Yes. And of course, well, I think a good many small farms combined to make up Ballerina, but they had much bigger farm buildings and that kind of a thing there. It was originally a farm, which this originally was only a retired seaman's cottage.
Yes, yes. You don't, for instance, know whether the architect was brought across from Liverpool by your grandfather or whether he was a local Manx?
I think he was local.
You think he was local?
Yes. I think very probably it was the same man that did these others, you see, that Johnny speaks of.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he'd be a bit older then.
Yes,
but,
and you see, he knew where to get the Poulvache marble and things like that, that a foreigner wouldn't have known.
Exactly.
And I can't remember the name of the man who told me that his old uncle was a stonemason and had polished these pillars. It was stupid of me. It would have been worth recording, but I don't know.
He was the man who lived down at Portivallen or somewhere, wasn't he?
Yes.
I think you remembered his name before when we talked.
Mm.
I think so, because you said you went to see him.
Oh, no, the man I went to see at Portivallen, I think, was the man who lived on the calf.
Ah, maybe, yes. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yes, mm. Was one of the lighthouse keepers.
Mm.
And having married a Manx woman, when he retired, instead of returning to Scotland, he lived here.
Are there other things in the house, in addition to this room with the Poulvache marble, are there other rooms with Manx, specifically Manx stone or Manx marble or Manx...
The two bedrooms... not today, but someday you might like to go upstairs and see the four-poster and the bedroom above. The bedroom over this and over the drawing room have both plain Manx marble mantel shelves. And in the schoolroom, there's a very old one that is also Poulvache marble, but not polished to the same extent. At least I think it's bulrush marble. Hmm. Maybe slate, I don't know.
Hmm.
The second question, which, if you could throw some light upon, would be exceedingly valuable, is the keel and the Manx cross slab, the Manx crucifix,
yes,
that came from the calf of man. Johnny Crellin says that the exact location where the keel was is not now known, though he did know and speak to a Mrs. Clegg of Douglas, who was born on the calf, and who remembered that as a girl she sat on the stones of the keel before they were pulled down to make walls. And he wonders if you either remember, or if you remember your father or your mother ever mentioning the keel, and have any idea whereabouts in the calf it might have been.
No, mother probably would have known if we'd asked her, but I never heard where. And I don't know of anyone who could tell that. The old Hudgens are gone, else the man might have known, because he seemed to know every inch of the calf.
Mm.
And of course, the keepers and their wives lived on the calf in those days when mother was there, 90-odd years ago.
Yes.
And then, a little later, they were moved to Port St. Mary and houses built there for them. And the men went to and fro, I've forgotten how many weeks each one spent on the calf, because of children going to school and that kind of thing.
Mm.
So, and today they live in Port St. Mary and go, I think, go backwards and forwards.
Well, that's pity. He also wondered, presumably from around the same time, whether you remembered people catching seabirds and salting them down for food, and if not seabirds, whether you remembered catching rabbits and salting them down for food.
Oh, I think they caught rabbits and did that, because mother couldn't bear rabbit. She'd lived so much on rabbit on the calf in those 2 or 3 years that she never wanted to see rabbit. I think they did catch rabbit and salted them down for food. And of course, like everybody else, they had pigs and they salted the pork down. All Manx farms 100 years ago lived largely on pork. If you had any kind of a farm, or rather I should say cow, I think, principally, if you, because, of course, for father, I know, did grow some corn, because he fattened beasts, and they had sheep, but so they would naturally have pigs with cows. We had pigs here, and always, though it wasn't actually a farm, Granny always had a pig with going with the cows, and salted it down. There was always plenty of pork. Pork was very cheap in the early days. I remember Auntie saying 6 pence a pound.
When you say pigs going with the cows, do you mean literally roaming over a big field, unconfined?
Yes.
Not
you just turned them out into a field and they wandered round and fended for themselves. Of course, here, this piece round here was divided into five fields. There was the grass field and the hay field, which would be grass the following year, you see, and hay grown for the horse for the winter, and the turnip field, which was turnips and carrots and potatoes, and the oat field and the barley field, five. And the barley was all sold. The oats was more than enough for Polly for the year, so that's Polly and the rats. But I know that latterly a good deal of it was sold because it was difficult to keep it sufficiently without the rats getting to it. And it was really cheaper to sell the oats and then buy later on than have it all eaten up by rats.
Yes. Johnny's next question is one I find completely fascinating because it would never have occurred to me. He draws my attention to the fact that today one grows a certain type of potato and one eats a golden delicious apple, you know. And he says, what about the garden in the early days of Miss Gibbs' memory at the Grove? What sort of flowers were grown for use in the house? Did they really smell better than the flowers do today? And can she recall the early names of the varieties of potatoes that were used, and of apples and of onions and of things like that?
Well, I can tell him that the apples were Gladstones, and the pears were Mary Louise, and what is the other one? Oh no. The Americans or the Australians call them Bartlett, but we didn't call them that.
Oh yes.
Funny, I've forgotten at the moment. I'll probably think of it. There's a list somewhere. Those were the two, the apples and the pears. One of the apples they called Greenings, and the Gladstones and Greenings, and what was the third one? Greenings have got some other name now. I found it in Gladys Worrell's book, and I'm so sorry. When I was told to choose something from the house in memory of her, I was so sorry I didn't take that book. I don't know what became of it. It was a lovely book, rather like that poultry book of apples and pears. Mm. And
what about potatoes?
Oh, potatoes now. What were the old potatoes? Drum something.
Drum?
Drum gold or drum something. Drum.
Was there a Sharp's Express in those days or not?
No, but there was a forerunner of Sharp's Express. What was that now? I wonder if Henry in the Combine would remember potatoes.
Well, we can come back on this another time. What about onions?
onions now. I don't know that they had a special name. They were just onions.
Mm. Well, then, what about the flowers?
Flowers were gillyflowers, that's wallflowers.
Mm.
And asters. And what was the other thing we grew so much?
Larkspur?
Yes, larkspur. And I call them bachelor's buttons, but they weren't they. The flower, that's the name, those in the hedges, but the ones in the gardens had another name. Yeah. And of course, the wild hyacinths, Spanish hyacinths, that's the pink and blue and white, as well as the woodland ones that are just blue.
Did you have daffodils and things like
yes,
that?
Yes, there were daffodils and jonquils.
Mm.
And jonquils are now divided, have all sorts of, you know, special, they've specialized, but they were just jonquils in those days, as apart from the ordinary double daffodil.
Tulips?
Tulips, yes. Blue, white, and red. No, I don't think there were blue. It's hyacinths, I think, with the blue. There weren't blue tulips, they were white and red. And there were also striped ones. I remember very gay striped ones. Now they've developed into something bigger still, and they call them parrot tulips or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, they were.
And what about roses?
Well, the roses, there were a thing called Marshal Neal that you had to protect in the winter, or because it was sensitive to frost, and the old-fashioned fat cabbage rose that had such a very sweet scent. And talking of scent, the sweet peas in those days were much smaller, but very sweet scented. The one of the flower catalogues a year or two ago, I haven't noticed lately, about 5 years ago, you could buy old-fashioned sweet scented sweet peas. And they're only about half the size of the modern beautiful things to look at, but they scented a room, because I know we got some and grew them that year.
And then in
the summer, Aunt Mary used to fill the bottom border with geraniums. Scarlet geraniums, which of course she hung up by the heels or did something to protect them during the winter up in the loft.
Mm.
But they were taken in and then put out again.
And did you have climbing roses such as Albertine?
Yes.
Was that?
But they were. There was a thing, a Gloire de Dijon, that climbed anywhere.
Yes, Gloire de Dijon.
Yes.
Mm.
I know we had that. The Marshal Neal, I think, was in the greenhouse mostly, but there was a Gloire de Dijon on the end of the barn, and there was one somewhere else, and they were sweetly scented.
Did you have clematis in those days or not?
Hmm?
Did you have clematis in those days or not?
Oh, yes, some people had.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we had.
No.
I think it was too windy.
Mm-hmm. And what about the things that one sees in the island now, like, for instance, hydrangeas?
Oh, yes, they've always been there.
They've always been.
Yes. And fuchsias, no end of. And some people went in for a variety of fuchsias, you know, not just the common ones, but wonderful ones with great big bells and frills and all sorts of things. Mm. I know at one time Aunt Mary had, she was the aunt who died comparatively young.
Yeah.
She had masses of fuchsias. Of course, you see, trees weren't so big. Well, she died in what? 1891, I think. So that was a good many years ago.
Mm.
And the trees weren't so big, and that greenhouse off the drawing room would grow more flowers then. Now it really isn't much good for anything except ferns.
Yeah. When was that built, that greenhouse?
Mm.
When was it built?
That greenhouse. Well, the first one was built now. I wonder when Aunt Kate came home from India. It must have been built about the time I was born, I think.
Mm-hmm.
About 1878.
The first one?
Yes.
This is the second one, is it?
Yes, well, it is. And the first one needed repairing badly during the First World War. And there was always timber being allotted for it, and the builder who had it in hand kept using up the timber for other things, so that in the end they had to make almost a completely new greenhouse, because the remains were too far gone to repair, if you know what I mean, except one corner. And that has had to be renewed since. And that was, of course, about 1919.
And did you grow grapes in the greenhouse?
Not then, no. Alice got the little greenhouse down at the bottom of the garden, and that was built for the vine. Somebody gave Uncle Edward a rod and said it was a very good vine, and he'd a good garden, but he'd no greenhouse. And he said to Alice, "Would you like to have this rod?" She said, "I would." And Auntie said, well, when she came home with it, Auntie said, "It's no good, you better get George Harrison to make you something for it." So George was a joiner who worked on his own and was always very obliging to us. In fact, he married a girl who was a maid here. And he built the bottom greenhouse, and the vine was planted and did very well as long as she could look after it. And then one year it got that grey must stuff in it. But in gardeners' question time, they said that most likely it was lack of water, that people in a dry summer didn't really realize how much water a vine needed. And I think probably that was true.
Mm.
But of course, I can't pretend to look after it.
No, no. When was the small greenhouse built then? What year was that, roughly?
The little one?
Yeah, roughly. I mean, 1920, 1930, 1940.
Well, let me think. It must have been built about 1928 or 29.
Mm-hmm. And what about herbs? Did you have a herb garden here?
Oh, well, we had a few herbs. We had thyme and lemon thyme and parsley, of course. And now what was that other thing?
Cloves?
No.
Marjoram?
Marjoram we had. And not cloves, but well, perhaps it was cloves. There was another thing, but I can't remember the name of it at the moment.
What did you do with the herbs?
They put this other thing in soup, I think, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the thyme and the parsley were the most useful, most used.
For what? For what?
Well, parsley you used in soup and in sauce and as a decoration on cold meat and so on. And thyme was used with stuffings and some soups. And lemon thyme was also used in as a flavouring.
Do you remember herbs being used for medicinal purposes?
Well, a funny thing was that there was a girl here ill, and the doctors had tried various things to reduce this fluid inside her, and her mother, I've forgotten that people's name for the moment, came here because she knew that at that time we had a lemon verbena tree. There's one, I hope it survived this winter, but we had at one time three of them, but there was a very stout one in the front of the house here, which eventually died, this lemon verbena. And she said, could you spare me some of your lemon verbena? I want to make a drink of it for this girl. And she said, it's in France, it's always used for this kind of thing. And I think it would be beneficial because the doctors have given her, they've been the best part of the week trying various drugs to reduce this fluid and nothing has happened. And so we said, oh yes, of course, dear me, you have as much as you want. So we cut largely at the thing and gave it to her. And whether it was the last straw or not, probably the last straw after all the doctor's things, it did the trick.
What did you cut? The leaves or the flowers?
The leaves, yes.
And they were boiled down, were they?
Yes.
Like mint or something?
Yes. She stewed them and gave her the liquid. was an old thing that had a... We had it for ages. It had a very strong and rather objectionable scent, and it was used medicinally in some way or another, but I just can't remember the name of it.
Was it a flower or a
shrub? It was a plant with greyish looking and grey leaves. And it wasn't that pretty velvety grey thing, you know. What do they call that? Lamb's ear.
Mm, it was not
lamb's ear, but it was something that was